In my core, I'm a teacher. If there was a great way to make a living being a teacher, I would be a teacher. I thrive when I teach.
I'm Dan Smolin, and this is the Tightrope Podcast. We tell the stories of people who are defining the future of work. Our guests walk the tightrope, away from meaningless toil and towards work that is profound, protects the planet, empowers people, and is fun to do, meaningful work. The stories that our guests tell and the insights that they provide will inspire you to connect with work and experiences that stoke your passions and make the world a better place. For the future of work is meaningful work. It is week 4 of working from home, and we are sharing our time, broadband, and square footage with loved ones and the household's other members. Work before the COVID-19 coronavirus crisis was tough enough, but now all of us are struggling to make working from home a successful and rewarding endeavor. And that's why this week we turn to podcaster and entrepreneurial tribal leader Isar Matis for his insight and inspiration. As a former fighter pilot turned business executive and startup entrepreneur, Isar developed expertise in time, stress, and work-life management. With a deep passion for teaching, he demonstrates how we can manage our time and work priorities and also to be an attentive family member. In this episode, we cover a lot of topics, starting from Isar's experiences behind the controls of an F-16 fighter jet, where he mastered split-second decision-making, learn to focus and effect successful outcomes, and then debrief his actions to expand his mastery. You will discover Isar's deep motivation to be a great teacher, and we encourage you to listen to and learn from the considerable insight he provides in this episode to turn at-home turmoil into successful work and life endeavors. Simply put, Isar is helping to guide the future of work to a good and satisfying place. We spoke with Isar Matis earlier this week on Zoom. Isar Matis, welcome to the Tightrope.
Thanks, Dan, for having me. It's great being here.
You're welcome. So let's get started. You started your career in an interesting career path. What is it that you did as your first major job?
So when I was 18, I joined the Air Force and I became an F-16 pilot in the Israeli Air Force. As an F-16 pilot, at that age, you first of all, you think you're invincible, but it very quickly becomes a day job, right? It's something that you do day in, day out, and you get trained day in, day out to think in a certain way, to act in a certain way, and it kind of becomes a very important component of your DNA because you're doing this basically every day for several good years. So that was my first step in my professional career.
So as a fighter pilot, I've learned that, like you, a lot of fighter pilots, once they retire, become entrepreneurs. Why is that? What's the secret sauce that you developed, you said, in your DNA? What experiences or what enhancements in your life happened that you were able to pivot into a successful career in business and as an entrepreneur?
It's a great question. I'll take you one step back, which is a lot of people kind of laugh about fighter pilots and how they are character-wise. And some people ask themselves, like, okay, why is that? Why are so many fighter pilots kind of like the same character-wise? And the second question you ask yourself is the Air Force picking just these people that are like that? Or is it the training that makes people that way? The answer is it's a combination of both, right? To be successful in flight school and graduate as a fighter pilot, you need some characteristics coming in. But then 10 years of daily training really sharpens the edges of many of those skills. And there's a lot of them, but if I have to focus on a few, I'll give you three skills or three characteristics of fighter pilots that translate directly to the business world. One is the ability to make the right decisions under pressure. As you can imagine, flying very high speeds, pulling high Gs in a very dynamic environment under real threats forces you to make cool judgments in a very tense situation. And since you do this every single day, your brain learns how to suppress the pressure and the stress and make educated decision in that situation, which again translates directly to the business world and allows you to make better decisions. The second aspect is dedication to the mission. When you're a fighter pilot, the mission will be achieved, period. And it starts very, very early. And again, even the start translates directly to business, which is the planning. You plan every detail. You consider all the what ifs. You try to do the execution with as little surprises as possible. And then in the execution, if there are surprises, and there's many surprises, just like in business, there are surprises when you do flight sorties, you deal with them and you get the mission done. So that helps you, again, that dedication in business obviously helps you a lot achieving the goals of the business. But I think really the third component that I want to talk about is the most critical to success in business and success in life. It translates to my personal relationships with my spouse, with my kids, with the way I drive my car in traffic, everything, which is debriefing. In the Air Force, we debrief everything. It forces you to do something that is not very human-like, which is to gladly admit your mistakes out loud, which is something that is very unnatural in the beginning. But when, again, you do this every day for so many years, it becomes a part of you. I debrief everything I do. In my head, subconsciously, I debrief when I park my car not perfectly. It's at that level. So in business, everything that I do, I look back at it and say, okay, this is what I haven't done right. This is why I got it wrong. Here is where I need to improve it. I take a mental note for myself and I make sure I don't repeat these issues again. And I teach the same thing to all the teams that work with me. So over time, you just become better and better at what you do, which means you become better and better than your competition if they're not following the same guidelines. And every fighter pilot you're going to talk to is going to tell you the same thing.
Okay. However, I think I mentioned to you, I used to live in a community with quite a few Marine Corps F/A-18 pilots.
Okay.
And they were some intense guys, intense, impenetrable. I'm trying to wrap my head around the life or death split second decisions that you make in a fighter jet going a couple G's. And then, as you say, you debrief and you're this cool customer. Does that come out of years of training and making it like muscle memory? How does that happen?
Like I said, I think it's a combination of both. I think it's a combination of your core personality. But yes, a lot of things progress through the years, right? You learn how to do this. You know how to deal with these situations. And you know how to stop the adrenaline once you're back on the ground. Now, by the way, a lot of us are adrenaline junkies, right? I skydive, ride dirt bikes, mountain biking, snowboarding, scuba diving, poker games, right? Wherever you can get that adrenaline rush, I'm in. And again, a lot of my squadron buddies are exactly the same way. So I think it's kind of who we are, but we also, like you said, very, very good at knowing how to put that to sleep when we need to in order to focus on other things.
And yet you have this wonderful relationship with your family and your wife. And you got a smile on your face and you're just like a happy guy. And I think that's wonderful.
Thank you.
So I want to talk about your podcast because I was a guest on it recently. It's called the E-Tribe Podcast. But before we get into that, I was wondering if you can take us through your pivot into the business life, into the business career and as an entrepreneur.
Okay. So my first exit point out of the Air Force was 2008. Sorry. I wish it was 2008. 98.
Okay.
I wish I was that young. It was 98, 99. And in those years was the booming high-tech economy globally and definitely in Israel. So, you know, a lot of startups were very, very successful, were raising crazy amounts of money, were giving crazy terms and stock options agreement to anybody who joined. So I left the Air Force. I left the Air Force for a small startup that did training and simulation solutions for the military in the beginning, then we pivoted to a lot of other things. As part of that startup, so I joined, we're about 25 people in the company. I became a project manager. I run some crazy large international, super complicated projects. And when I look back at it today, it was complete recklessness by my CEO because I had no clue about business. I came out of the Air Force and got to manage these multi-million dollar projects in several different countries overseas with a lot of interesting groups involved, But it worked. And from there, I moved to sales and marketing. And very quickly, I became the head of everything sales in the company. And again, because it's a small startup, I did sales, I did marketing, I did business development. I was the one setting up the actual physical booth for trade shows. I was the one running and producing the brochures. I was the one doing sales calls. And I had a small team, but that's what I was doing then. We decided to grow into the US and we took a small team, talk about entrepreneurship. So the CEO, myself as the head of sales and marketing, and the CTO moved to the US to start a branch of the company here in Orlando, Florida. So that's what brought me into the United States. Several years after that, I did an executive MBA. And shortly after, I understood that I want to do things on my own. And I left that company and started my own startup. That startup raised a decent amount of money, developed a very interesting solution, and it never grew up into something that we were able to commercialize at the scale we wanted to, and we had to shut it off. But the investor, the main investor in that business, took me over to his company and said, I want you to do the same thing, but within my big corporate. So I want you to run your little startup within our big corporate. So that's kind of my story.
And what was the name of that company, that last company you mentioned?
So that company is Tirico Holidays. Mm-hmm. Tirico Holidays was the largest wholesaler of travel in the United States and the third largest in the world. And I was brought over to develop a B2C channel for that company.
Excellent. So you mentioned that Tirico had some interesting business problems. What were they and how did you work to mitigate them?
Okay, so Tirico Holidays was growing very, very fast, which is a great problem to have, but it's still a problem.
Sure.
And when I say growing very fast, it's in the hundreds of millions and growing by 100 million, 150 million a year.
Wow.
Global company, 30-something countries, and we couldn't hire people fast enough to sustain the growth. So the first thing you do is you go and steal people from the competition, right? That's the easiest thing to do. You go like, okay, I have two big competitors. They have people all over the world talking to the same customers. Let's bring them over. And we did across all the levels in the company, like from grunts in the trench lines all the way up to executive management. The problem is that it doesn't work from a way of doing business. It doesn't work from a culture perspective. It's just not a good fit. And a lot of these people are great people. They just were not successful in the way Tirico was doing business. And it was a big problem. And we said, okay, so what do we do now? How do we get people to enable the company to continue growing at the pace we're growing it right now that will be aligned with the DNA of the company? And somebody threw an idea, and I don't remember exactly how it started, but somebody said, why won't we start our own academy? And then we started rolling with that idea of starting an academy and what does that even mean? And we made it happen. And what the academy really had is it had several different components. The first component was kind of like your expertise, which is a headhunting / recruiting global department that we did not have before. We had an HR department, right? And they were kind of like hiring people, but they were not professional trained recruiters. So we hired a recruiting team, and what they did is they looked for talent around the world in places we needed them. But what does that mean? So we were not looking for people with necessarily travel experience or travel business experience. We were looking for people who were extremely talented, highly driven, young individuals. So our team went to the best business schools usually around the world in areas where we had a need and handpicked people we thought would be a good fit for the company. We then would bring all of them to a academy facility we built in Orlando, Florida. We paid for their temporary relocation. We paid for their meals. We paid for their accommodation. And we even paid them a small salary. And we brought them in for 11 weeks of very rigorous training. It was boot camp kind of training, right? They would show up at 8 a.m. for breakfast. They would go into training sessions at 9 all the way to 6, 7, 8 p.m. And then they would stay and do projects until the middle of the night sometimes. And the professors, if you want, of that academy was the executives of the company. So each and every one of us had the opportunity to teach for a week to a week and a half on different topics. But the result of that was incredible, because what we got is the people who successfully graduated, and it's not everybody, about 60% graduated, and then about 20 to 30% of those dropped very, very quickly. But those who stayed were incredibly smart individuals that came from the markets in which we needed them and then were shipped back there, who now had our DNA, the same DNA of the executive team, because they were with us for 11 weeks. And for many of them, it was the first real professional job they had, or one of the first. So really the first experiences they had is with people. And we used to laugh, we made them Turicans, right? From the word Turico. And it was a huge success. Within about 2 years, most of the middle management of the company was people who graduated from the academy.
What you just said is so important. We talked about this, I think, in podcast interview that you did with me, which is sometimes hiring managers will just go hire based on some type. It's like central casting, go find me somebody who's got an MBA out of Wharton. That doesn't mean that, like what you said, they're going to have the DNA coming in. And as you said, we made sure that our recruits had our DNA. Training and empowerment is so important. And I'm really inspired that you were a part of this and you learned how to do this and do it well.
In my core, I'm a teacher. If there was a great way to make a living being a teacher, I would be a teacher. I thrive when I teach. I had the opportunity to do this as an instructor in flight school in the Israeli Air Force Academy. I had the opportunity to do this training companies to use our product in the Israeli startup I was involved in. I had the opportunity to do this in the Crummer School of Business, where I graduated. I go back every now and then and do guest lectures. I have one actually coming up in like 2 weeks. And I had the opportunity to do this in Turico Academy. I love doing this. I enjoy teaching other people and see them excel in something they want to excel at. And the Academy was an amazing experience, an opportunity to do that while helping the company grow. It very rarely happens that you get this kind of opportunity.
Okay, so I'm going to use that theme of teaching as a pivot into your baby, into the E-Tribe, because I think that's really one of the things that you're trying to do here, to teach listeners how to pivot successfully into an entrepreneurial pursuit. So take us through the E-Tribe. What's it about and what's its mission, Isar?
Yes, so the E-Tribe is exactly what you said. The E-Tribe is me trying to take my entrepreneurial experience and business experience in the past 20 years, and with the help of other people, which I consider experts, people like you that I handpick that bring specific expertise, share that knowledge with as many people as possible. And there are several reasons behind it. Part of it is because I find it inspiring. I listen to a lot of podcasts. I follow a lot of people. I read a lot of blogs. And I get ideas and I get inspired by people who are able to be successful and do something. And it gives you sometimes that extra push you need in order to go that extra step and do something. So if I can do that to somebody, I'm humbled. The other thing is really the knowledge itself. Most mistakes that a business person is going to make, somebody already made.
Right.
And there's no reason to repeat them if you can learn from somebody else's experience. You know, I have a tagline on one of the pages on my website. People really like talking, and it's a term that came up in the last few years, about growth hacking. To me, the mother of growth hacking is learning from other people's mistakes. If you can avoid the biggest mistakes that most people make in various facets of the business, right? Whether it's the actual management of the business itself, raising money, cash flow, marketing, management, time management. If you can learn how to do these things right, and I'm not talking about academic education, I'm talking about very practical, how you really do this in a business, I can help so many people be successful in a business they want to be successful at. And to me, whether I know about it later on because people write to me or I don't, and I just assume I'm helping people, it's an amazing, wonderful experience.
Okay, for our listeners, think about what he just said, because You know, when we all started off as entrepreneurs, and I too consider myself as an entrepreneur, I wouldn't have gone out as a recruiter on my own, hanging my own shingle, if I didn't feel I had the skill as an entrepreneur to do it. But there were a lot of experiences I didn't have. Cash flow, raising money. I had marketing and promotional experience, but I never ran a headcount before. And so what ISAR is doing here is helping us all with the fundamentals so that we're not making mistakes on a fundamental level. We make them on an experiential level based on the learning that we need to do to fit into that capability of raising money, scaling a business, hiring people, marketing, promotion, management, firing people, all that stuff. So good on you, ISAR. That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
I'll say something because you honed in on an interesting point, which is the fundamentals of the business. I recorded one episode that I actually don't like personally, but a lot of people told me it's great. And you know how it is. We have our favorites and our non-favorites as podcasters. That's not one of my favorites, but it's called The Big Lie of Small Business. If you go on Google, why businesses fail, 80% of the responses you're going to get, or you can just run your own survey, right? Ask your buddies, friends, people in your network. Most people will say cash flow. That's the answer, right? 70%, 80% of the businesses fail because of cash flow. And I'm like, this is horrible that that's the answer. Because the cash flow issue in not 9 out of 10, but 19 out of 20 times is the outcome of a fundamental mistake that you made in running your business. And I'm using the word that you use because it's the perfect word, right? Somewhere along the way, you made one or several mistakes in your business that made you run out of money. Now, is that always the case? No. Coronavirus happens and everything shuts down. Well, that's out of your control, right? You can still, by the way, if you're smart, agile, and have a lot of tools, can pivot your way out of that. Not always. But if you set it up things correctly, you have a chance. But in the other 19 times where there's no coronavirus, in most cases, you either done something wrong in the very initial research on the business you were going into, maybe it's not sustainable to begin with, or in the processes or the way you set it up or how you're running it, and then you ran out of money. Yes, it happens. And then we're like, oh, I ran out of money. That's why I went out of business. No, that was the outcome of doing some fundamental mistakes earlier on.
That the business model wasn't completely well thought out.
Yeah. One way or another.
That right. I think that makes perfect sense. You know, I never really thought about that. I probably too would have said cash flow, but cash flow is like when you said to me when you interviewed me, you know, about writing a job spec. And I'm like, no, go back a few steps. This is a go back a few steps. There's something fundamentally wrong with the business model. And I would argue that most startup entrepreneurs, that's going to affect probably 98% of them. That they haven't thought out every conceivable F-16 cockpit stress-inducing problem that could come about in creating that business model for success. I would probably add another thing, and that is an exit strategy.
Yes.
Because anybody who's willing to give you money is going to want to know they can get their money out. And I notice with a lot of people that I talk to, they're sort of living in the moment. Yay. You need to think of an exit strategy. You're going to retire at some point. You may not want to do this anymore. Absolutely. What is it that you're going to want to do? That's where the tightrope comes in, is helping people oftentimes pivot to second and third act careers. I'm into my fourth act. That employs an exit strategy. So these are all really, really interesting aspects.
I agree. I'll bounce back off of that to something in that particular article that most people don't think that way when they start a business. I think a lot of people start a business either because they're really passionate about something or because they don't have a choice, right? They were looking for a job. They couldn't find it. I'm like, okay, what can I do? I can do X. And then they go and do that. But they don't really think about the structure of a business, the process of a business, the future of the business. What I write in that article or in that podcast is from day one, you have to think as a CEO of a company. I don't care if you have a lawnmower and you mow grass, right? Mm-hmm. You are a CEO of a company. And that leads, one of the things it leads to, what you said. You need to run it like a business because one day you would want out.
Right.
And when you want out, this thing will be worth nothing unless it's a business managed and running like a business. if it's you kind of doing your thing day in, day out, there's nothing to sell. It's you. So when you get out, there's nothing else left.
So one of the things that I think affects all entrepreneurs is time. It's a non-renewable resource. You got it until you lose it. And it's how you use your time that's really important. I bring that up because in real time, our listeners, all of us are dealing with some interesting dynamics that affect time. You and I both are working from home. Well, we do that, but everybody who is in executive or managerial work is not in the office right now. They're sharing living space with family members, significant others. And when the workday starts, they have to go into work mode. They get on Zoom meetings. Yes. They have to manage their time well. And how do you tell that to a five-year-old who's saying, Dad, Mom, I have a question for you. So let's talk about time management. And for those of us who are now, and we're on meetings all day long, we're writing emails, we're learning how, you know, the stuff we did in the office was so time-wasting. And yes. Now that I'm working from home and I'm on Zoom and I have to start thinking in short time increments, maybe 15 minutes at a time, what things are you seeing, Issar, that are opportunities for all of us to use this experience of being parked at home during this COVID-19 coronavirus crisis? What kinds of things can we use to make our time management better, more effective?
Brilliant. So here's the thing. First of all, I'll go back to my background, and we kind of talked about it a little bit. My entire career, I managed people in different locations. I had teams in Israel, in India, in Romania, in Spain, in the UK, in various places in the US. Actually, through my entire career, I was managing more people that were not next to me than people that were actually with me in the office. So for me, the whole video conferencing thing and managing people remotely and managing time according to different time zones and different meetings is the only thing I know. Actually, put me with 30 people in the same room, I'm not sure I know how to do how to handle that. But going back to what you learn from this is you really learn very effective time management, especially when you do this on executive level in a company that you need to generate hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And I think to me, the key to all of this is prioritization and focus and communication. There's three different aspects, right, to what I'm saying right now. One of it is having the right processes. And whether it's you or with a group of people you're trying to manage, you got to have a process in place that you can stick to, because otherwise you're just winging it all day long, every day, day in, day out. In the office, it's a lot easier to wing it because the office itself gives you some structure.
Right.
At home, you're going to end up building Legos and helping cook all day long. You will never get to the things you want to do. So you need some process in place. Example of a tool that I use for my process, and it will connect to the other part of the process, which is priority. I have a list of priorities. I prioritize again, or I review my priorities on a daily basis. And for the things that I think are critical and cannot be avoided today or tomorrow or this week, I set up an actual meeting on the calendar. I address that meeting as if I'm meeting with the CEO of my largest potential customer client. Mm-hmm. Nothing moves that meeting. Not the kids, not cooking. Unless the house is on fire, that meeting happens, and it happens with the topics that I define for that meeting. Mm-hmm. No email comes in, no WhatsApp messages. I move everything aside, and I spend that hour or 2 hours doing that one thing that I said that is the most critical that needs to happen that day. Connected to that is tools, right? So what tools do you use in order to make this happen? So obviously, from what I just said, you can understand I use a calendar. I just use Google because it's free and it's great and it allows me to do everything that I need. But you can use whatever calendar you want. It could be pen and paper if that's what you like. The other thing that I use religiously is Trello. Trello is a free task management platform. When I used to work in larger companies, I used other platforms that cost a lot of money that work in very large corporates. But Trello does just fine. And really what it allows me to do is create tasks, put them in different buckets, and as I mentioned, manage their priority. I literally drag to the top of the list the things that I think are the most important for that particular day. And I do this every morning. And usually at night before I go to bed, I go and visit the list and say, oh, today this and this came out. I forgot to add it to the list. I add it in there and I prioritize again. What that does, in combination with what I said before as far as the meetings, it says, do I complete 100% of what I was planning for the week? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Nobody does. Or I shouldn't say nobody. Some people are better than me. They probably do. I don't. But at least I know that I complete the critical things that I prioritize as the top priority for the day or for the week. The last component, as I mentioned, is communication. And when you run a business, communication is with the other teams. How do you make sure there's transparency? How do you communicate those priorities and short-term changes that everybody's aligned with it? But when it's you at home, it's still communication. What you and I are doing right now requires communication. I have three kids at home. Mm-hmm. One is a five-year-old, right? But at this time that we're recording a Zoom meeting, nobody else is using the computers. Nobody's watching Netflix. Nobody can jump and throw the basketball in the house because they do this all the time. Mm. Nobody can run cars up and down the stairs, which they do all the time because they're bored. But it has been communicated in my own little company right now, right? In my house, that this is happening right now. And this is what I'm asking you to do. So we planned it up in advance that every one of them has a quiet activity that does not require a streaming device, because that will damage the bandwidth and you and I won't be able to talk as clearly as we are right now. And we're executing on this. So communication, process, and tools to be able to prioritize and focus on the things that are important.
And I guess the thing about that is they understand they're going to be rewarded with your undivided time.
Absolutely. I think there's a huge benefit to the current situation related to what you just said. Yes. I spend a lot more time with my kids. I spend real quality time with my kids. We live in Florida. The weather is perfect. Real estate is cheap. So everybody has swimming pools and we spend an hour a day at the pool. And I've built more Legos in the past week than I've done in the last 12 months because my little guy likes Legos. And so I build Legos all the time. And I'm reading books with my older daughter. So now we're halfway through Lord of the Rings. So oh, wow. I get really high quality time with my kids, but I still manage to do the things that are high priority for me, even if I have to do them at 9 p.m. I think the work-life balance I have today took me a week or so to adjust, but I think it's the best I ever had.
So you pointed me to a book written by another guest of yours, Nir Eyal, who wrote a book called Indistractable.
Yes.
And the reason he wrote it is because we're all distractible.
Yes.
And I'm about 65, 70% through the book. Thank you so much for the recommendation. I did talk about it on my blog. And the points he is making are like, yeah, I can see why we are so distractible. And here are things we can do to make the day more balanced, more effective. Like I said to you, your kids are rewarded. They're not bothering you when you're on a podcast with Dan. And after that, they get rewarded by having undivided, really quality, wonderful, memorable time with you.
Yes. I think Nir's book is incredible. He's a very, very interesting individual. It's worth listening to the interview I've done with him. But it's definitely worth reading his two books. He actually has another book. The other one is called Hooked, which is about product development in business. But Indistractable is life-changing to anybody because it really teaches methodologies and provides systems and processes how to better manage your time and align it with your personal goals and priorities, whatever they are, both personal life and business. So definitely worth reading the book or listening to it. I'll admit out loud, I'm listening to the audiobook.
Excellent. So really my last point about this is the opportunity that evolves from crisis. The crisis we're all in is here on this planet. Practically everybody is in a stay-at-home order, working from home, socially distant from people they would normally deal with. So because we can't move to the cubicle where our friend is who we're co-managing the project with, we have to manage our time so that we get to that person and we use that time effectively. Do you feel like these skills that we are being forced to learn about time management will enmesh themselves in the future of work or not?
First of all, I really hope so. But second, I think yes. So this thing is not going away next week. we're going to be in this situation for a few good weeks. And if we look at Italy or Spain or other countries that have been this before us, we will be in this stay home, communicate over the internet situation for, my guesstimate, at least 2 months. You've heard this before me, I'm sure. 21 days gets you into a new routine, right? That's the time it takes the brain to adjust to something new and make it a part of your regular self. 21 days. It's going to be more than 21 days. So a lot of people are going to adjust, and this is going to be the new norm. But that new norm, while it has a lot of disadvantages, once you figure it out, and I think we're all forced to figure it out, once you figure it out, like we said, have a lot of benefits. You have a lot more free time. You have a lot more flexibility on when to do things. Now, yes, there are meetings on the calendar. There's stuff. You have to be at 9:30 a.m. Eastern time for this conference call with his father of other people. And then there's another one at 10, but then there's another one at 4. And in between, you have 4 hours. In those 4 hours, you can choose what to do. And you can go to the pool with the kids, or you can read a book, or you can take care of that issue that you have in your backyard that you really wanted to take care of. And you can go back and do the extra work at 9 p.m. after the kids go to bed. And if you figure it out, you can find a better balance in your life. And I think a lot of people will want to maintain as much of the good part of it as possible in the future. And I think the employers, the companies who will understand that, and they will see the opportunity here, will benefit as well. Because think about what we're saying. You can lower the overhead by having a smaller office, hot seat the stations, let people come to the office when they have to come to the office, let them work more flexible from home. And I'll go back to what I said before. As long as you have processes, communication, and tools in place to manage effectively, then everybody wins.
You know, you just described why I think the over century old model of an 8-hour workday, a 40-hour work week is going the way of the dodo bird. It's extinct. Because of this thing we've been forced into, we have to use all of our time effectively with all of our constituents. And our constituents are our coworkers, our bosses, okay, our clients, but our loved ones, they need time too. And they too are adjusting to this new thing. I had said to you when you interviewed me that I thought this was going to go away. And as a replacement to all that, people who work would be rewarded based on their outputs, not on the number of hours they worked. And you went, yes! I think this could do it. I hope it could.
Listen, when I manage people, and again, I manage people that are overseas from me for the past 20 years. They've heard me say time and time again, if you do what needs to be done, I don't care. Forget about I don't care. I encourage you to be on the beach drinking margaritas. I want you to have fun. I want you to have free time. As somebody who's working with me, I consider all the people who worked with me friends, and I want them to have a good life. And hence, if they can finish the tasks, if the KPIs that they can affect, that they can pull levers to move, are moving in the right direction, I don't care where they are. I don't care how many hours they work. I don't care what they do, when, and with who, because the outcome that the business needs is happening. And I think if, as a world, this thing now, the coronavirus, the stay at home, will force us as a community, as a race, to go in that direction, it's a huge benefit.
And I'm going to turn back to something you just said because it really resonated with me. And that's sort of the death of flippancy. I don't care goes away too. I encourage you. I want you to live a wonderful life and drink margaritas at the poolside.
Yes.
I think it is incumbent on us who have people working for us or who we work with for them to be happy and fulfilled.
Absolutely.
I think that's a part of the future of work too. I really do.
Amen.
So one last question, and this borrows from my own tagline for this podcast, which is the future of work is meaningful work. Issar, what tips and hacks can you offer our listeners who are striving to follow their dreams of doing meaningful work?
Several. I actually recorded an interview with a very interesting guy a few weeks ago, exactly on that topic, on how to chase your passion and make your passion your work. So if you want to listen for another 45 minutes on that topic, you can do that as well. Or just listen to Dan's entire podcast series. And there's a lot of great information over there. But from my personal experience, I think there are three major components to being able to do meaningful work. One, and that's the very first step, is finding out what's meaningful for you. And if I go back to the question you asked me when I interviewed you about, oh, write a job description. Said, no. Go two steps back. Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to do meaningful work. What is meaningful work? Well, mm-hmm. it's a different meaning to every person, right? So mm-hmm. you have to dig deep and figure out what's meaningful for you. What are you passionate about? Out in a way that will last not for the next 6 weeks, because my daughter is now very passionate about a specific singer, but she won't remember his name 2 months from now. Right. But something you will be passionate about for the longer run that will be meaningful for you. So that's the first thing. The second thing is it takes planning and dedication, because if you'll just say, oh, I'm passionate about mowing grass, this may not be able to sustain the current life you're living right now.
Right.
Now, it might if you plan accordingly and you're willing to invest in order to get there. So if you're saying, okay, I really like, now let's expand it, I really like gardening. Start thinking about how can you sustain your life in a gardening-related business. You can start a podcast. You can start a blog. You can cultivate specific plants and write specifically about them. Or you can say, I'm going to create another path of passive income, save money, invest in real estate, do whatever that needs to be done. So 5, 6, 10 years from now, if I follow my plan, I will be able to deal for the rest of my life mm-hmm. in the stuff I'm passionate about. So it doesn't happen overnight. So that's the second thing. And the third component is really being able to understand what skills, tools, processes you need in order to do that meaningful work. Because the fact you're passionate about it doesn't mean you have the tools to actually make it into a career. So right. part of the process is learning. Learn and learn and learn and learn more. And today, learning is easy, right? The information is there. You just have to find the right source and stick with it. This could be the right guy on YouTube. This could be a university course. This could be a downloadable course from a blog, right? If it's credible and it's somebody who knows what he's talking about, but you got to find credible sources of information and learn the knowledge and the skills required to do that meaningful work you decided you want to do. One last thing, sorry, which mm-hmm. is critical, I think. And it's critical. And I'm going back. Well, actually interesting. It will take us full circle to your first question about being an F-16 pilot. In order to do meaningful work, to make the changes in your life in that direction, you will have to take risks.
Yes. Yes.
Some people will need to take smaller risks. Some people will have to take bigger risks. Some people will need to take bigger risks than they're willing to take. I, 2 or 3 times in my career, took a bungee jump with no rope. I did. I left Israel with nothing. No savings, came to the US. I was making $40,000 a year for a family of two. Can you make it? Yeah, but I left all my support system back in Israel. In 2008, I lost my entire life savings on a house I bought 3 seconds before the market crashed. What did I do? I took a student loan of $60,000 and went and did an executive MBA, and then I quit my job and started a startup. Is that for everyone? No, absolutely not. I do not recommend this. I did not sleep for 6 months. And I deal well. And I deal well with stress.
Yes.
but it worked. All I'm going to is, if you want to have a significant change in your career from your day job or anything else that you're doing into something dramatically different that you find meaningful, you will need to take risks. And if you're not a risk-taking person, you may need to do your meaningful thing as a hobby, which is fine. Mm. But just know that in advance.
Sage advice, my friend, sage advice. So if somebody wanted to find you and your website and your podcast, where on social media would you point them?
I'm everywhere. So if you look for Isar, I-S-A-R, last name, Meitis, M-E-I-T-I-S, you'll find me. If you find another one, by the way, let me know, because I don't know of anybody else. So it's not like I'm John Smith. But if you want to find stuff that's relevant to what we talked about, just go to theetribe.com. If you want to listen to the podcast, you can just go to theetribe.com/podcast. If you want some materials related to what we talked about today, about tools and processes and how to manage time and how to do remote management, I actually created a specific landing page for Dan's Tightrope listeners. And again, it's very easy to remember. It's theetribe.com/tightrope. A few useful pieces of information over there on tools and things you can do to manage time, manage remotely, and be better prepared for, I think, for, like Dan said, where the workforce and the work in the world is going.
And as my guests know, I post all of their social media points. And by the way, that link that you talked about will be on my show notes page for this episode. And Isar Meitis, I want to thank you again for being a guest on The Tightrope. We're going to have you back. You were an interesting guy. And
yeah, you're a great interviewer. You pull the best out of me.
Well, thank you. And so are you. And I consider you my friend. And as a friend, I want to get you back on because you're a great storyteller and a really nice guy. And what really inspires me is how much you care about helping people. It's a really noble thing. So thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
You too, Dan. Thank you as well. And it was great being a guest. And like you said, I would return back every compliment. You're an incredible person and a great interviewer. And I would love to be back on the show. Thanks again.
And you will.
Links to Isar Meitis' social media are provided in the show notes for this episode at dansmolin.com. Please join us again for more inspiring stories from people who walk the tightrope to seek and do meaningful work. You can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts or listen to current and past episodes on our website at dansmolin.com. I'm Dan Smolin, and this is the Tightrope Podcast. Together, let's walk the tightrope to find and do meaningful work. For the future of work is meaningful work. And do remember this, our best days lie ahead. Let's connect again next week. Stay healthy and socially distant, everyone.